Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Good afternoon. We are in for a treat today. We have a very unusual guest at the Doctors Roundtable, a friend and also somebody who is so unusual in her field. We'll be talking today about environmental medicine, some news about it, the myths about it, and some success stories with it. So I want to introduce Dr. Susan Tanner, who's one of our very rare environmental medicine physicians here in Atlanta. And she studied at Emory University and did her postgraduate work in internal medicine in the Atlantic City area. She practiced primary care for almost 20 years in the northern part of the city out in the Lawrenceville area, and then in 2002 made the switch over to environmental medicine. And I'm going to let her explain in a minute what that is, because I think there's a lot of confusion around it. But in general, if you think about environmental medicine, focuses on the interaction between us humans, our environment, and how different things in the air, in our food, that we're exposed to affect our health, and a lot of times mostly in a negative way affects our health. And I think a lot of times the patients that she sees, she gets to at the very end of their rope. I kind of think of you, Dr. Tanner, as kind of a house doctor on TV show, because you're a diagnostician where people come after they've seen physicians, 7 physicians, 8, 19, 20, and they're just at their wit's end, and you have to be a little bit of a detective outside of maybe traditional medicine to see what in the heck is going on. So why don't we let your expertise start by just telling us a little bit about your field and how you got into it.
Well, thank you, Tanya. It's good to be here. Environmental medicine does sound, as it is, that you're looking at the external environment, but what I want to make clear is that it also includes the internal environment of the patient. So our history involves a lot of what has happened to them through the years. We take a very detailed and chronologic history with every patient, because everything they've had, they've been exposed to, whether it's an illness, whether it is an external exposure, even their genetics, all of that is very important in determining what may have brought them in to see me, which is when they are truly at the end of their rope.
Mm-hmm. So I saw on your website one of your slogans is genetics kind of sets you up, and then the environment kind of pulls the trigger
a little bit.
Yep. So
genetics loads
what you
the
start
gun,
with.
Environment pulls the trigger.
That's right.
And that's one of the sayings that we have in our group of specialists.
Yeah.
Here.
So tell us a little bit about how you got into this field from internal medicine.
Well, I think I've always loved detective work. I guess I liked Alfred Hitchcock's stories back when I was a kid. But in medicine, it is detective work. And I think, unfortunately, the current medical model takes us away from that. We're quick to try to find a diagnostic label, and then what drug can we use to treat this
exactly.
label?
We want the pill to fix me right now for my copay.
Exactly. And that's not what we're about. We're really trying to figure out why you have what you do. So it's not what you have, it's why you have it. And I think that's the big change in what I do now versus what I used to do. Mm-hmm. Some of that came from frustration, in that I would see chronically ill patients over and over, and I really felt guilty. Kept giving them prescriptions and didn't really feel like I was making a difference in their life or helping them be better. It was the same problem every month, every week, every year, only getting worse, and quality of life issues were there. Plus, a lot of the medications that we use frequently had their own set of side effects, which then just set them off on another course of getting worse or
so
getting another
label. Kind of
compounded.
Label.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept thinking there had to be a better way. And actually, due to some issues with my own family, I was serendipitously, I guess, led to another physician who had already been a member of the Academy of Environmental Medicine for some years, and was just fascinated and enthralled by the fact that there were people like this, mm-hmm. that this existed, that there were tests that you could do that actually could help determine what was going on inside the body and not just a blood level that was told, you know, this is normal. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse when you feel awful and going to see a physician and having blood work done and saying, well, it all looks good, looks normal.
But you feel bad.
You feel horrible, mm-hmm. and you think, well, it must be in my head, and that's not
I hear that so many times. And I think that's why people keep trying someone new, trying another physician, trying another, so they get very frustrated in the process.
Exactly.
And the expense of duplicated tests and everything else, it's very
over
frustrating.
And over.
Over and over.
Yeah,
so you got interested in the root causes.
Exactly. And you have to look outside the box sometimes with that, or look at a different medical model, not just this is what you have, but this, and this has led to this, and therefore we have to reverse this.
Yeah, so I'm just as surprised to hear you talk a little bit about you have to do double duty, not just in the environment, what touched you, but let's start with actually you. So let's talk about what are some factors that you might look at for like an initial evaluation.
Well, our history taking actually begins, if we're able to do this, was what was your mother's health like when she was pregnant with you?
Wow. Okay.
Because that may even have some
impact. I'd be a very unreliable historian probably for you.
Many are. But the funny thing is our initial history questionnaire for patients is about 12 pages long. And some get very frustrated midway. Others are delighted because they think, gosh, I never knew that. They'll call their mom up who might be 85 or 90 years old, and they find out things about themselves that they never knew. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the fun in this is that every patient has their story, and it's unique, and it's unique to them, and it tells why they arrived at where they are now. So we'll ask questions about maternal health, their first knowledge of any illness they had as an infant or a child. Was their development normal? Where did they live? What kind of house? Were they farming community? Did they live in a coal mine area? And some pockets of illnesses will even be found in that, oh, yeah, you grew up around the coal mines, and, wow, there's a lot of this. And no wonder you had allergies and asthma when you were a child. So those sorts of bits of information, just one by one, aren't that much. But when you take them in the whole continuum and look at health as the total body load of everything you've ever had or been exposed to, then it starts to explain, again, what brought them to me.
So you take this extensive history, and then are there diagnostic tests that go with it?
There are.
And based on what you see,
yes,
you hear.
And that's what leads us. There are a jillion different tests you can do, and many of these are out-of-the-box tests. They're not the things that you would normally get done when you go to a regular physician's office, although we do those too. But we're trying to see if what we think may be going on tests out properly by this, such as, let's say someone has had a lot of exposure to lead. They grew up in an old house with old lead pipes and lead solder. Well, what if they've got a burden of that in their body? We know that lead is very disruptive to the immune system. Many people who have this have some neurologic issues, subtle, not something that you would just say, oh, you've got Parkinson's, but processing issues, ADD. So we're looking at the burdens that these things may be in part causative.
And then you also, on that questionnaire, I'm guessing, have a lot of environmental questions that are not just their home, but where they work and where they go to the gym, and because people move, we're so mobile these days.
That's
so,
right.
Do you ask a lot of questions?
Absolutely.
About, yeah.
Every place they've worked, they've lived, what kind of car they have, has it had water damage?
Wow.
This out here, but if you have a front loader washer and you have mold issues, you better get rid of it because you're not going to get rid of mold in a front loader washer. So these are little things to us, but for a patient who's ill or who has been made ill by their environment, then they're big deal sorts of things.
Right. Now, I think it's such a small specialty. There isn't a fellowship for this, is it? You just kind of get into it. It's so very, very narrow.
It is narrow. And the first meeting that I ever attended was at the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, AAEM.com is the name of the group. And you can pull that up online. It's an interesting website. It puts out the mission statement of what it is we stand for and what we try to do. But I was absolutely blown away by the first meeting that I attended. There were probably 350 physicians there, not just from the U.S., from all over the world. The majority were from the U.S., but all with the same frustrations that I had felt as a primary care physician, most of them having had at least one family member who had been affected negatively in some way by the environment, and all with a driving passion to find out why. And probably one of the most generous groups of physicians as far as sharing knowledge, really wanting to put it out there to the others and help teach and help you learn. So that was really what changed my thinking in medicine, was that first meeting. And I think once you step out of that box of traditional medicine and find that there is another way of thinking, it's real hard to jump back in the pool.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of ways to get to a good outcome. That's for sure. Yeah.
Dr. Tanner, you've already shared with us how much different exposures you're looking at in environmental medicine, but from anything from pesticides to mold, air pollution, or radiation. But could you speak to the most common that you treat?
Well, sometimes it's a combination of all of those, but I would say it seems that I have a huge abundance of patients who have been affected negatively by mold. And it isn't just allergy. That's one thing I want to make very clear, is that mold can have also a toxic effect, which affects the system in ways you don't always know. It can be neurologic, it can be GI, it can be musculoskeletal. So people don't always make that connection that there could have been a mold exposure. And since we live in Georgia and it's such a humid state, and especially in the spring and summer months, tendency to build that up in the home without necessarily recognizing it. Mold can make people ill without it being black mold growing up the walls. About 20% of the population has the genetic type to react to mold in a negative manner, in which it causes extreme inflammatory response in the body. So they may be diagnosed with many other things, anything from rheumatoid arthritis to pulmonary disease to irritable bowel, when in fact it may be an inflammatory connection to mold. And so I would say that's probably one of the leading diagnostic areas that I've seen, especially in these last years.
Very good. Now, some of you listeners are going to say, who is that other person talking? And forgive me, so let me introduce Dolores Hartley. She's visiting me today and does periodic guest hosting for me, and I asked her to come and join us. Dolores is a nurse who worked with Northside Hospital for many, many years, and worked with a lot of physicians around the community, right, Dolores?
That's correct.
She also has her master's in business administration, and she works with our sponsoring company, HealthGate, as a community liaison. So she's in and out meeting with doctors all the time about what is happening in our community, and especially in the Atlanta area. So thanks for joining us
today,
Dolores.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to you, Susan, and ask a question about, it's fascinating to me that you're talking about really genetic predisposition to like a mold allergy. Right?
Well, to a mold sensitivity, not so much the allergy, although some allergies are also genetic, but the predisposition I'm talking about is more about the inflammatory or toxic response to mold. And not everybody has that. Some people can be in mold and doesn't bother them a bit. They're fine, or seem to be.
Mm-hmm. How would you know, only from the symptoms and the severe symptoms, response that mm-hmm. they're having, or are there tests that you actually
There is a test, and it's a LabCorp test that was actually designed by a doctor in Maryland, and it helps. You have to decipher it with a Rosetta Stone once you get it done, but it helps you see what genetic type you have and if this is going to be a person who's
like
going to
a
have
profile,
a tremendous problem with mold or not. I do that sometimes. Other times, I try to save the cost and just if the patient's demonstrating certain symptoms, and if we've asked enough questions about the house and had them maybe put a few mold plates out to see if they're collecting some spores there, then we can actually, you know, tell that this is probably what's going on.
So mold is one of the most common types of patients or situations that you uncover, that you find. What would
it
be
is.
Another?
Chronic fatigue is another. And then, goodness, the causes of chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, and those two diagnoses get interchanged so often. But
I sometimes think fibromyalgia now is like the dumping ground for
it. Is. It's a label. It is a diagnosis, but the causes of fibromyalgia, just as they are in chronic fatigue, are so varied. It's not necessarily the same thing for two people. So, again, the history is so vital in determining how we address it. How I address fibromyalgia in one patient will be completely different than another. Although I say that, but we always start with what we can change. And I guess with every patient that comes to see me, there are three things that I tell them they must do in order for anything I do to be successful. They have to have clean air, meaning that they can't live in a nasty environment. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they have to have clean food. And by clean, it's specific for them. We try to remove the common inflammatory foods, but also in time may get more specific about food sensitivities or other things that may cause an increased burden on them. And the third is clean water, just trying to drink plenty of it, for one thing.
Things we take for granted.
Exactly.
In our country.
Exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about those. So just if you're making just, we'll go down patient paths, mm-hmm. but just in general tips, things that the average consumer do, what can they do to purify their air? What kind of tips do you give to clean the air?
I would first make sure that your house doesn't have a problem. If there's been moisture intrusion, mm-hmm. if there's a damp or wet basement or a nasty crawl space, those really have to be dealt with because mm-hmm. you can't cover over that with an air filter or anything mm-hmm. else. So if that's an issue, I mean, you've got to address that. But I think secondly is the type and quality of insulation that's used in building your house. I'm not a big fan of blown-in insulation, although I know it's commonly used now.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
It creates a lot of tiny particles that get into your HVAC system, blow around, and a lot of people have had to see the ENT, and they look up their nose and find all these little ulcerations, and it's from these
oh, wow.
little particles that
mm-hmm.
dig holes in there. So mm-hmm. it can be kind of nasty.
Yeah, yeah. We think when we build the house, it will stay in one place.
Right.
We don't realize it's being blown
exactly,
everywhere.
Exactly,
yeah.
All of that.
And what about these room air filters? What's
your
opinion?
Some of them are very good, and there are certain ones that I'll recommend to patients. I probably better not mention any commercial mm-hmm. names on air, but these usually fall into very high efficiency or HEPA
you
air
think
filtration.
They help?
They do. There's certain units that can be put on the whole house, but if I have an extremely sensitive patient, I'll have them use a very good unit in their bedroom and keep the door closed and the windows closed and keep that air going 24/7 so that most patients who sleep in what we call an oasis tend to do better during the day.
Okay.
So
well, that makes sense. You're in there for, what, 8-9
yeah,
hours
sleep.
Probably.
And then if you've got problems with dust or mites, and, you know, ask them, please don't bring your pets in the bed with you. I mean, I love dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. I really do, but they are not the best sleep mates.
Mm-hmm.
So,
so, not the cleanest sleep mates.
Well, no,
sure,
and they
yeah.
have little boogers
yeah.
they bring in with them right. from outside that don't need to be in your bed.
Right.
So,
right.
So a few other little things like that. And there's some other simple barrier methods for pillows and mattresses. Believe it or not, some people have lived in a really moldy house and they decide to move, which is a good thing, but they drag all their belongings from one place to the other, and especially soft goods like mattresses and pillows are laden with spores, so they wonder why mm-hmm. they're still sick.
I was thinking that when you were talking about putting the dishes in mm-hmm. to capture spore counts yep. and things
we tap
like that.
Test or have patients tap test their mattresses or their clothing or things to see, and if they've got high spore counts, they've either got to get rid of it or if it can't be cleaned or fogged or properly handled, mm-hmm. it's got to go.
So remediation of problems
absolutely.
In your air in your home are certainly. And for clean food, that's a whole nother show topic,
oh,
I know. But let's just pick out a couple. I know. Let's pick
out
a couple, three.
Try
things.
To avoid the pesticides, the mm-hmm. hormonally treated animals, which I know all these labels mm-hmm. disavow any knowledge of any hormones being used. But trust me, if you're going to one of our local grocers and buying. Amen. So, you know, again, keeping the load down, that's the whole mantra in environmental medicine is reduce the total body load, however you can do it. And mm-hmm. so, no, maybe you can't eat organic food all the time, but if you do a lot of the time and avoid mm-hmm. what you can, every little bit helps.
Well, that's kind of like the carbon footprint, right?
Yes.
So only for ourselves, keeping
that's right.
our environment, our body's gas is very similar in that regard. And water.
Water, Atlanta's finest isn't the worst water in the world.
Yeah.
So, but I don't like people consuming lots of chlorine. It's associated with possibly bladder cancer and some other things. So I prefer filtration. You don't have to go crazy with it, but just mm-hmm. a good point of use filtration is good. Mm-hmm. I don't love plastic bottles. You know, lots of PCBs that have been linked to other mm-hmm. Their hormonal mimics for one thing, so they can create some problem. I'm not perfect. I drink out of them on occasion. But, again, trying to be aware and do what you can to reduce your own load, I think,
right.
is important.
Right. Well, let's talk about if we're a patient coming to see you.
Okay.
And so we present at your office. What's like a common, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Let's start there.
They may say that, exactly. Mm-hmm. Or they're frustrated because they've been here, they've been there, they'll bring in their roster of medications that they're spending bukus of money on, even if it's on a copay, and they don't feel well, their quality of life stinks, and so we just start from there. And usually there will be some initial complaints. It may be fatigue, it may be pain, it may be bowel problems, it may be extreme sensitivities to things. But I would say the most common things walking in the door are probably fatigue, weight gain, and since everything that happens to you does affect your hormones, some people come in primarily saying, oh, my hormones are off. I know they are, when in fact they are off, but why are they off? Is it your body that's not producing right, or is there something else that's
in the
way?
So back to the root of it rather than take Synthroid or whatever.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
Right. Okay.
And that's not to say I don't prescribe these things. Mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm. If they're needed, then absolutely there is a place for medicine, so I don't for a minute mean to imply that I don't write prescriptions. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we try to get to a point where we figure out why we're taking this, and if there is another way more naturally that we could do it, we do.
So I'm thinking if I'm a patient coming to see you, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm going to sit through a very long history.
You will.
And I may have to do things in my home, water or food.
Right.
So it probably, and being the little bit of detective, this takes time.
It
so
does.
What is a normal time expectation that it takes to you to get just where you have an understanding of what is going on? Is that weeks? Is that months? Or how does that kind of come together?
It is usually weeks. Reason being, the first visit is about an hour and a half at least.
I'm
sometimes
thinking it
a little
would be
longer.
Very long.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And we generally start with some testing. Some of it's blood work, and it may be blood work that has been done in another doctor's office and been told is normal, but we may look at it a little bit differently. And then, so that at least gets us started. Plus, we do try to do some coaching on that first visit to help patients understand how important it is that they have clean air, clean water, clean food. Then the turnaround time on some of the specialty tests, and I'll call them that because it involves patients taking boxes home and collecting bodily fluids of various types. Mm-hmm. And the turnaround time on those results can be, you know, 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So at the point that we have all of that, we have them come out. And from looking at those results and going back to their history, I try to give them an explanation of why and what I think is going on and what we need to do to fix it. So we start a fairly aggressive plan. It really depends a lot on how bad off the patient is when they come in, how long they've been ill, and how diligent they are in getting started with some of these treatments. But I would say most people are going to feel at least somewhat better within the first month of treatment. They aren't going to be well, especially if they've been sick for
chronic,
a very long time. But at least, you know, at least a month. I ask them to give me 3 to 6 months to really get them to a place where they are feeling a lot better. During that time, they may not notice it because it can be a very gradual and hopefully continual improvement. But often 3 months down the road, they can look back where they were.
See a significant change.
And it's like, wow, you know, I really do see this, and I am that, and I can do this. And so sometimes those markers of success are very small steps.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, if they'll stay with it, they do get much better.
So we start with the consult, and we come in, and we get a baseline. Then you do some testing, which may you have to test more than once, depending on the first set of results,
correct,
where you're led. And then you start making you make a plan.
Yes.
And then start tweaking it and make incremental changes based on what you see in their symptom control.
That's exactly right. We use symptoms to help direct our care once we've got an initial lab work. We're not constantly checking or having patients undergo more and more and more tests unless it's something unavoidable. We really let their symptoms, their improvement or lack thereof, help guide what our next steps are.
Okay.
Could you give us some of your common treatment modalities, just some exact examples of that?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, of course, the change in the diet and fluid intake and all of that. But as far as things we do in the office, depending on how ill a patient is, we may use intravenous nutritional. Sounds a bit radical, but it can make a life-changing difference very quickly. Vitamin C, B vitamins, lipoic acid, a number of other things like that can be given in an IV, much like an IV antibiotic, and it totally bypasses the need for absorption, so gets in the system a lot more directly, and patients can feel better faster and exact a change, especially if they've got some GI issues that might get in the way of some of the oral things we're using. We still use them, but it just takes longer. So that's one thing. Another is the use of a dry sauna. It's not just to make you feel better, but sweating is one of the best modalities for removing toxins from the system. And skin is your largest organ of your body. And
that makes
sense.
If
we can get sweating going, and you know, some of my sickest patients don't sweat. They don't, and that's a really bad sign when you just never sweat. Means you're not able to excrete. So all of these toxins remain sequestered into the fat tissue of the body, and you just get sicker and sicker. So, but it's a medically supervised sweat. I want to let you know we don't let people get dehydrated or pass out or, you know, have other problems with that.
So do you have this in your office? Is this a treatment in your office?
I do have that in the office. And sometimes we'll do a combination of having them be in the sauna for a while and follow it up with an IV. And we may do a series of a few of those just to really get them started. Some patients feel so much better doing that that they'll actually go and purchase their own sauna. Mm-hmm. We have some companies that will make those, and they have a house that can accommodate one.
That sounds good for the non-sick person.
It sure is. I mean, it's been around for years. Scandinavian families commonly use sauna, and they remain quite healthy, and it's just their understanding that sweating helps get you better.
So with one session, how much improvement could you expect, maybe?
With one session of sauna, probably not that much. I mean, that's more of an ongoing type of thing. But the IV therapy, sometimes immediate results to some extent. And again, some people who are really doing pretty well start kind of flagging down a little bit, and they'll call up and think they need to get plugged in for a little infusion. Come on in. We'll do that.
I got a hot date tonight.
Time for some vitamin C. Very, very large doses of vitamin C can be given IV that one would never tolerate orally, and that's one of the best nutrients for the adrenal system, which just helps kind of perk you up as far as fatigue and immunity and all of that.
What about detoxification? So we're kind of getting into that topic.
That's sort of what we do. So a lot of that is detoxification.
Like part of a detox plan.
It is. And there are other supplements. We use a lot of oral nutrients as well, usually specific for each patient. It's not I don't have a list that I give to everybody. Mm-hmm. I really try to be very individual with that. Mm-hmm.
I know this is a big time of year, too, when people are like, the new you, the new year.
Yes.
It seems like everybody, everywhere I go at lunchtime, people have a handful of their supplements. Yep. I'm detoxing or, whatever. So
sort of like spring cleaning for the body, but you do it a couple times a year.
Yeah, that's good. Kinda... Sounds healthy anyway. So nutritional supplementation, sauna therapy, detoxing. What about immunotherapy? Do you do any?
I do. It's a little bit different than traditional allergy therapy, but we do find that the allergies and particularly food sensitivities create just another burden on the body, so it's part of removing the load. Some people are so exquisitely sensitive to both inhalants and foods and all of these things that they could not undergo the traditional allergy testing. So we use a much gentler form of allergy testing and treatment, which can be administered at home by the patient with drops under the tongue. It's safe. It's very gentle. And, we don't run the risk of anaphylactic reactions with this.
Well, I had never heard of that before. That's very interesting. And do you use chelation therapy? Because I know one of the things you may have to deal with is, you mentioned earlier, the lead poisoning. So I think people are exposed to way more metal than they maybe ever thought or they realized. Is that...
That is correct, and again, I think some people lack some of the mechanisms to remove this from the body, and they don't know they have it, because once exposed to heavy metals, lead, mercury, arsenic, aluminum, these will sequester, again, out into body tissues and not necessarily remain in circulation. So if you go for a lead blood test, unless you've got current exposure, it's not going to show anything, and same thing with mercury. Mm-hmm.
So the blood result might be fine, but as you mentioned, it's in the fat tissue.
It's in the tissue. So the only way really to determine that is to administer what we call a chelating agent, which is a pharmaceutical agent, actually, that goes in and binds with heavy metal ions and pulls it out into the urine. And through that,
and then
we
can excrete
tell
it.
We can tell about that. Lead's a real issue, because we think that we don't even know exactly how to ascertain how much one may have. We can tell if it's high, but it goes into bone and may reside there for many, many years. So there's argument, should you try to pull that out? Should you leave it alone? And, there are many different arguments to support both ways. I'll be attending next weekend another conference on heavy metals, so maybe I'll have more
the latest and greatest update
on that.
You have to update me. We'll let the listeners know. I want to talk a little bit about how some of what you see affects organ systems, because I know that... you know, like mold, I would tend to think like in terms of respiratory, you know, like I can't breathe, I wheeze, I whatever, I have a mold allergy. But I know that it can be multi-system. So
that's correct.
How do these different things show up in terms of organ damage? I think a lot of people, especially when you're seeing chronic patients, this may have gone on for years.
Right.
How much improvement can you really expect in some of these patients?
Well, some can get tremendously better and do. I've seen one in particular who was truly at the point of death, and it wasn't, I have to be very clear about this, it was from mold, but he did not have mold in his body per se. It wasn't a mold blood infection, as mm-hmm. you might see with someone who's severely immunocompromised. It was the inflammatory response. And when you're talking about inflammatory response, it can attack almost any tissue of the body. In his case, it was lungs, it was musculoskeletal system, it was digestive, to the point that he was emaciated, he could not swallow, he could not eat. His breathing was problematic, but not from the lung allergy. It was more inflammatory.
Is this the case study we were talking
yes,
about where
it
you
is.
Were you were doctor number
19
by the time they had gotten to you?
Yes.
What is wrong here?
Yeah.
Because I think initially it probably wasn't severe, but did it get worse and worse?
It did. He was getting much better, and that's one of the things that's very confounding about this whole process is that he was actually doing great, but he wasn't quite well. And he left to go to a conference and ended up staying in a hotel that had just a really bad moldy HVAC system. So he got a big hit with spores. And his system was not well enough yet to withstand that. So what it did was it really slapped him down and started him on a terrible downward spiral. And sometimes that will happen. Patients are better, but they get hit again, and their system is even more reactive, if you will. So
let's look at this as a case study. Mm-hmm. So for doctor number 19, you come and you... How did you find that out? I mean, if you think so, how many tests have been done already? The file had to
right.
be like 5 inches thick
well,
that you had to
read. Well, it was fairly thick, but how we got to it really came to the questions that nobody else had asked about his home, and found out he had a very damp basement, found out that he had spent a lot of years in that basement, also as a photography buff, so he had his dark room and chemicals and all that, so he's getting hit from that as well. And some of the things besides having patients take a plate or two home, and we talk about agar plates that will help collect spores. We did send him home with some of that, but we'll also swab up their nose and have them blow on a plate and see if I get any spores out on that plate. and indeed we did. And so that started some of
the
that
questioning,
process going.
To narrowing
exactly.
down what his particular
But
point.
His was very specifically inflammatory with musculoskeletal tissue. Mm-hmm. And it was very unusual. It didn't fit the criteria of anything else. And he had seen rheumatologists. It almost looked like some sort
like
of
a lupus
weird,
or
yeah.
systemic something.
But they would say, no, it's not that, and send him on his way. And he was just getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And ultimately, I think, would have died. He did have to be hospitalized just because his nutritional status had gotten so bad that he was beyond the point that we could do anything mm-hmm. at my office.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully, he recovered and is doing extremely well.
Mm-hmm. That's a great case to hear about. But can you share another one with us?
I think... probably would have to do with the frustrated female who
don't
cannot
be outing
lose.
Us here, Dr.
no,
Tanner.
No.
Dolores and I are getting our ears perked up.
Well, I put myself in that group too. That has to do with weight loss and so much of that and fatigue. It is related so often to improper hormone balance, to food sensitivities, and those all get rolled up into a ball together. So just trying to get those separated out. And this particular patient could not lose weight, had been told time and again her hormones were fine because she was still having regular periods, and her thyroid was fine because her TSH was normal. And TSH is just a measure of how well the pituitary is telling the thyroid to work, not anything about how functional the gland is. And come to find out, she clinically was quite hypothyroid. She had a number of food sensitivities that were causing excessive cortisol production by the adrenals, which is like cortisone, which is mm-hmm. going to pack on weight. So just simply by regulating that, making, and for her, it was really some relatively few dietary changes
made an immense difference in how she felt and functioned day to day and all of that.
That's very exciting to hear. So, because many times we don't hear all those other factors
right.
mm-hmm. at all.
Now, you mentioned hormones. What's your take on bioidentical hormones versus traditional, like Synthroid, whatever?
Well, I'll use Synthroid if I need to. Mm-hmm. We often will use some of the older compounds like mm-hmm. Armour or Natrathroid because they contain a portion of thyroid called T3 that's not in Synthroid. But as far as other hormones, such mm-hmm. as female hormones, if a patient's going to use those, I prefer not to ever use the synthetics. The most common pill for years was made from pregnant horse urine. It is mm-hmm. not the same thing as the estrogen that we make. And the other, I guess, argument I have is that so many women who have received a hysterectomy are told they don't need any progesterone because they don't need it since they don't have a uterus. And that makes no sense to me because you're not trying to achieve a balance mm-hmm. if you're only taking an estrogen. So that gets into another whole topic that mm-hmm. we could spend a day on. But
we'll have you back for that topic.
But balancing those is extremely important. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. yeah.
Okay.
And just as an aside, you'd ask about other hormonal effects from some of these mm-hmm. illnesses. And one thing I will bring up is some interesting research about patients who have had chronic mold exposure and subsequently developing pituitary problems relating to the production of growth hormone. Even though we mm-hmm. have stopped growing, we still need growth hormone as an important regulator of everything
else.
There's a
lot that you can pick up any paper and look at growth hormone.
Absolutely. And these patients have been rendered completely flatlined pituitary-wise by the mold toxins for growth hormone. So mm-hmm. that's just another thing that we look at with all that.
Yeah, that's a lot to keep track of. So the patients come to you, they present, you're the doctor that is the detective that figures out, oh my gosh, what all is going on everywhere, not just you sitting here in my office. Once you get me better, do I stay with you or do I just see you for an episode in my life or how does that work?
Well, I tell patients, I'm always glad to see you, but I'm not going to keep dragging you back in here if you're mm-hmm. doing well. Mm-hmm. Once we've tried to give them the tools of how they can live well, they don't necessarily have to come back in. Mm-hmm. Some of them are ill enough where they do. We have to keep adjusting things, but I don't try to take the place of their primary care physician. Mm-hmm. They have a very definite role in their lives, and I do not want to interfere with that. And they'll go for their regular physicals there. Mm-hmm. But sometimes new problems emerge. Sometimes mm-hmm. they just want to be tweaked or checked or that sort of thing. So we'll see them again. But it's not on an absolute regular basis once we've gotten to the point where they're doing well.
Okay, very good. Now, we have the CDC here in Atlanta. I'm sure they keep up with all across the world environmental
they do.
Concerns and issues. Is there anything that's new that's coming out that in the area of environmental medicine that we, especially in Atlanta, should be paying attention to?
Well, I was really appreciative of the fact that the CDC produced a paper about scents and odors in the workplace. That wasn't widely published, but it is there. And they really don't recommend that people come in reeking of cologne or using those plug-in air fresheners or sprays. If it smells like flowers, it's not. It's a chemical. And these what we call aromatic volatile compounds are chemicals that you're breathing in, and they're not that good for you. So I was really glad that they came out with that stance. Because
that's funny you mentioned that. My husband told me a week or so ago his entire workspace was re-engineered. So because who could tolerate what from uh-huh. fragrances people would come in with?
Yep.
And everyone moved in a department. An entire department moved
wow.
because of a few people. So that's just amazing
it
to
is.
Me.
And usually the people who are the most sensitive, and we term that multiple chemical sensitivity or MCS,
okay.
and those patients are the ones who really cannot tolerate this. It's not an allergy. It sets off an autonomic nervous system response that creates all kinds of problems with them. And people think they're weird or they're faking it or that they're malingering or all of these other things when, in fact, they're very ill. And most patients who have this have a tremendous body burden coming from some other things that threw them into this syndrome. but they absolutely can't smell or be around those mm-hmm. kinds of odors or fragrances, mm-hmm. or they'll just get very ill.
Another thing, looking at the CDC's stance on their website, I was picking up, was just the concern about cell phones and radiation. And do you have any opinion on that, or are you hearing? We all don't know.
We don't know, and I am concerned. I mean, we've demonstrated that microwaves and radio waves and all of these things can affect cells. They see that under the microscope.
Right.
What does it do to us with our cell phone use and all of this? I don't know. I know that for years it's been said that cordless phones in the house produce just an immense amount of electromagnetic field. It's hard for us to do without these devices, mm-hmm. and that's a topic that I think needs a lot more research, but am I concerned? Absolutely, mm-hmm. but I don't know yet exactly what to do about this.
Right, yeah. I think it's you're reading a lot more. I think a lot of people are wondering, but yeah,
yes.
We definitely need starting to get some answers instead of what ifs, that's for sure. For those of you interested in following up with the CDC, you can go to www.cdc.gov/environmental and follow along on that paper and some other things that we've talked about. Any parting tips for patients? I feel like there's a lot of patients that could be helped by you that maybe have explored a lot of other options and they still remain frustrated. Certainly one is if you are in that category, then we'll let the patients know how they can connect with you in a minute. But any parting tips for patients?
I think my best tip would be ask questions. Don't settle that just because someone says your lab works fine, so therefore you must be fine. I wouldn't accept that if you're still not feeling well. Trust your inner voice. And I guess the biggest thing is make sure you've got clean air, clean water, and clean food.
That's right. Those are all good tips. Anything else that we have not covered that you think is important, as we don't have the chance to talk about environmental medicine very often?
I think that covers the bulk of it. There are a lot of individual topics that
there's
we could
so
go on for days.
So much to go on and monitor.
but I don't want to overwhelm anybody. This gives at least an introduction into what it is and how it is that we try to help people.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you joining us today. Dolores, I appreciate you joining us today. We'll hear more from you in the future.
Thank you.
And Dr. Tanner, let's let patients know how they can find you.
I'm located off of Howell Mill and I-75. The name of my practice is Southern Environmental Medicine. Our phone number is 404-845-7484, and our website is www.susantannermd.com.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us. It's always good to see you. And for you listeners, you can also visit www.healthgate.com. Dr. Tanner's on there, and you can find more information about her there as well. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.